Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. We'll begin the week this morning by talking with Manil Suri about his new novel. It's titled The Age of Shiva. It is published by W.W. Norton. It is his second book. His first was The Death of Vishnu that won a good deal of notice and favorable comment. It won the 2002 Barnes & Noble Discover Prize. It was also a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award. The new book is just out, and I'm sure that you can find that one. Both of them, I'm sure you can find them in the bookstore or in the library. In addition to being a writer, Manil Suri is also a mathematician. He lives in Maryland, where he is a mathematics professor at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign, Urbana, where we are, is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and we'll pay for it. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Suri, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I am fine, and you?
Pretty good. It's been a long time.
Well, we appreciate you talking with us again. I think perhaps I should mention that our guest, Manil Suri, talked with a colleague, with Celeste Quinn, on the Afternoon Magazine about The Death of Vishnu. And I think if people want to hear that interview, they would be able to find it on our web archive so that they can go back and hear that as well. And I'm pleased that you could spend some time with us here this morning, too.
My pleasure.
Maybe I just might ask, I'm curious about how you think your being a mathematician may or may not influence or connect with being a writer. Do those two things overlap, or are they very separate sorts of pursuits?
Well, I keep going back and forth between two answers. One is that they don't overlap, and the second is that they kind of help each other. I have very good arguments for both. In one model, One pursuit sort of helps when I'm tired of the other one. So when I'm sick of mathematics, I turn to writing, and vice versa. In the other model, they both have a similar type of process, where in mathematics you're looking at variables, while in fiction you're looking at characters, and you're trying to see where these different entities can take you, and you're following their trajectories in different ways. So there's something similar in there.
Hmm. When did you start writing, or was there a particular time that you can point to that you would say, well, this really was when I was began to be interested in writing seriously, maybe not necessarily for publication, but something that I felt was important and I really wanted to put effort and energy into?
Yeah, I can, actually. It was pretty much when I started being a professor, and so this was 83, and I decided one day that, okay, I'd always written in school, enjoyed it. Why don't I sit down and write a short story? And I wrote something. It was only two or three pages long. It was called Unfulfilled Expectations. And the twist was that it was the reader whose expectations were unfulfilled. Luckily, it didn't get published anywhere, which is fortunate. At that time, of course, I was trying to decide whether to send it to the New Yorker or the Atlantic, you know, which one would be better.
That's aiming pretty high for your first publication.
I know, and that just shows how ignorant I was about the whole thing back then. And it took many years. You know, I went to several writing—not workshops, but informal writing groups—and then I took some workshops, took some courses, and it was a very gradual process.
I understand that, or perhaps early on, certainly before the death of Vishnu, when you were writing stories, that you weren't eager to have your colleagues, your math colleagues, know that you were doing that writing. And I don't know whether that was because they thought that you shouldn't be dividing your attention, your efforts, or they would think that there was something wrong with the mathematician that was a writer. Why was it that you were keeping that so close?
Yeah, that's precisely right, what you just said about the fact that you aren't taken seriously if you do something else. And I remember it was pretty much when I started writing that a famous mathematician, who's also a very good bridge player and a renowned bridge player, his name is Ivar Stockgold, he came to our university to give a talk. And afterwards, one of the statisticians pulled me aside and said, "That was a terrible talk." And I said, "Well, how do you know? I mean, it was in applied math. You're a statistician." He said, "Well, he plays bridge. He spends too much time doing that, so it can't possibly be good." And so I knew that if I wanted to get tenure, it wouldn't be a bad idea to just keep silent about it. And so even when I was writing The Death of Vishnu, I remember one summer I went away to a writing colony, and I told everyone, "Okay, I'm going away because I'm writing a math textbook." And when I came back, they wanted to see it, and I said, "It went very poorly. I'll have to go again next time." But strangely enough, after the book did come out, two of the people in my department came up to me and said they were both actors. And one of them even said, "If the movie's ever made, I have to get him a role."
Both the age of Shiva and Death of Vishnu are set in India. And I'm not sure how many of your, when you were writing stories, how many of those were. I know that certainly some were not. Was there, at some point initially, was there a conscious decision that you were writing stories, say, set in the United States? And then at some point, did you then, again, sort of make a conscious decision? You said to yourself, "Well, I really want to write a story that is grounded in and set in India and Indian society."
That's pretty much what happened. I was writing stories that were not even necessarily set in the United States, but very abstract almost. Being a mathematician, my theory was, okay, you know, just like in mathematics, you have an X and it could stand for anything. Let's make the character as vague as possible. Let's make the setting as indistinct as possible so that the reader can fill in what they want to see in there. And that works for mathematics, but it doesn't work for fiction. And then I started writing about the U.S. I started a novel, which was about this boy who's growing up in school in Pittsburgh. And I realized I didn't know anything about school in Pittsburgh. And I said, "Well, maybe, you know, I should think about something I do know things about." And that's when I started writing a story set in India. That was the first story I wrote that was set in India. And then I started writing another story, and the second story turned into The Death of Vishnu.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Manil Suri. He has now authored two novels. The most recent, it's just out, is The Age of Shiva. And before that was The Death of Vishnu. That is now out, available in paperback. And the new book is out, published by W.W. Norton. You can go and find them in the bookstore, I'm sure. Questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to talk a little bit about the Age of Shiva, and we do this without telling people so much that they will feel that they know what it's all about and won't want to read it. Certainly the central character here is a woman named Mira. And this, it's in large part, it's about family relationships. It's about the relationship between her and her family, her father in particular, her husband, and maybe most important is, I suppose one might say that the Age of Shiva is, in a sense, a love story, and it's about the love of a mother for her son, which is something I think in India, which is a very powerful relationship, mothers and sons. Tell us about Mira.
Well, Mira is, you see her first in 1955 when she's about 17. And the thing to remember about that period in Indian history was that it was about 8 years after India got its independence. It was a very male-dominated society and very patriarchal. And Mira basically has to make her way through this society. And at that time, there were very few true freedoms available for women and true, you know, real choices that they could make. So Mira ends up, throughout the book, trying to assert herself, and the only way she can do that is to react against the patriarchy. She reacts against her father. She makes bad decisions. She basically barrels through various choices and always tries to control her destiny herself. So that's, if there was one thing that summarized her character, that would be it. And so when you're reading the book, you have to read it in that context. A lot of her relationships don't work out. But there is one relationship that she invests all her happiness in, and that's the one with her son. And that's what you were talking about. And this is a link that is extremely strong in India, especially the link between a mother and her male child, simply because sons are so valued in society there. There's even a separate word for it called Vatsalya in many Indian languages. And there are also very interesting myths that surround Shiva, Parvati, and their child. And so that's where the title comes from, and I'll probably talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But that's sort of the introduction to Meera.
I'm sure that there, over time, have been many male writers who have taken on women characters and have been faulted for not being able to get into a woman's head and really understand what the experience is like, what it's like to be a woman. And I think that's a difficult thing for a man. I suppose you go the other way around, it's difficult to really know how the other gender experiences the world. Why did you decide that you wanted to take on this difficult challenge?
I guess it was a challenge. When I finished the first book, I wanted the second to be as different from the first as possible. I knew that the first had some very strong male and female characters, but the male characters basically carried a lot of the action. And so when I started this book, I said, okay, let me try and have at least one of the characters be a woman. Interestingly enough, the book was really going to be about the son, Ashwin, rather than the mother. And what happened, though, is that I started writing about the mother, and it just came out. The first two pages that you see is just the first thing that I wrote down. And this voice just came from somewhere. Of course, I had to really get into Meera's head, get into her body almost for some of the scenes. And there were really small steps that I took, trying to map the world through her eyes, trying to see how she viewed her own son. And it was also a sort of high-wire act, just because I wasn't really communicating this to anyone. I wasn't showing what I'd written to women, for instance, and asking them, you know, is this correct or not? So it was a long process. And what happened, though, is that instead of writing about the son, Meera sort of took over the story. And there was a point where I was going to write a chapter or two about her back history. And, well, 200 pages later, the son still hadn't been born, so I knew that, okay, this is Meera's story. So I just went with her.
Let's come back to Shiva and the god Shiva and it's his significance in the Hindu pantheon and what it is you're drawing from that, how you're pulling that character, or what it is that you're intending people to keep in mind merely by making a reference to that aspect of Hindu mythology.
So Shiva is perhaps the most complex god, I think, in Hindu mythology. He's often known in the West, especially, as Shiva the Destroyer, because he's supposed to destroy the universe. But the mechanism in which he does that is very interesting. He's actually an ascetic, and he withdraws from the world. And it is his absence which is what makes the universe wind down, because he needs to be always involved. And if he's not, then that's what destroys the world. So the other thing to remember is, being an ascetic and withdrawing from the world, this makes those who yearn for him really long for his presence. So there is the sense of longing that is associated with Shiva, and that's one of the key feelings that I've tried to express in this book. Shiva is also associated with Parvati, the mother goddess, who is his consort, and she has a rich mythology that sort of interweaves with his own. One or two of the myths that I've used is the first one being that Shiva goes off into the forest. He's absent. Parvati is left alone. She hates it when he goes and leaves her. You know, he goes to meditate for many years. And in his absence, she decides one day that she's going to make a child for herself. So she uses little things from her own body and her bathing water and some scent and sandalwood and sculpts this little boy for herself. And then this boy turns out to be so delightful that she loses herself in his company, and they just keep frolicking around in the woods, and she basically forgets all about Shiva. And this is one of the things that I've woven into the story. The other part, the pairing of this, is another myth where Shiva and Parvati have a son which is born blind. His name is Andhaka. Andhaka grows up away from them, and when he reaches adulthood, his eyesight is restored, and the first thing he sees is his mother, and he's filled with lust for her. And Shiva has to come and put him at the end of a trident, and after many years of penance, he's able to be worthy to be a son again. So there's this Oedipal myth that is also woven through the narrative.
It makes me think, you know, here that an Indian writer would have one advantage, and that is that there is this very rich tradition that at least Indian readers would know, and perhaps all you would have to do would be to hint at it, and people would immediately connect with those kinds of with that story. That in India everybody would know those stories, and
actually,
in popular.
They don't actually. I have to admit, I didn't until I started really delving into these things, and especially the Andhaka myth. I was relating it to some people who are very religious too, and they didn't know about it. Even though in Bombay itself, there's a big cave called the Elephanta Caves, and one of the tableaus is of Andhaka and Shiva impaling him. And the reason for that is that I grew up in a pretty religious household. My father was very religious, and a lot of my family is still. But the thing is that a lot of the religion there is cultural, and there's very little philosophy that necessarily goes with it. So there's no theory that comes with it. And so I grew up, you know, knowing what you're supposed to do, but I didn't really know why, and I didn't know much about the myths. And I suspect some other people might be similar.
So, is this some kind of intentional connection with something that would be part of your cultural inheritance, but something that before you didn't really feel close to?
To some extent, that's what happened with the first book. I think when I started that book, Vishnu was just a name, and you know, someone said, well, you have a character named Vishnu, you have to connect it with a god Vishnu. And I started reading up on Hindu mythology, on Hindu philosophy, on religion, and read the Bhagavad Gita and so on, and really felt a strong connection with some of those texts and some of that philosophy, more in a secular way because I happen to be an agnostic myself. And that kind of drove that first book. And while some of that still continues in the second book, I found that the impetus for this book was very different. What happened with me this time was, again, connecting with something from my background, but it turned out to be Indian history. Remember when I said I was researching something for Meera's background? I started reading a book on Indian history, and I have to confess, history was always my worst subject. People come up to me and say, you know, mathematics was always my worst subject. Well, I say history was mine because I was just very bad at memorizing all the dates and so on. And if you think about India, we have a history that's thousands and thousands of years old. So that's a lot of dates, and I was never able to memorize them. Anyway, I started reading this book on post-independent India, and I just found this mesmerizing connection to characters that I grew up with, like Indira Gandhi and Jawaharlal Nehru, and for some reason this book was presenting it in a very lively manner. These characters were really coming alive. And I felt that, you know, I just felt something inside me that I have to write about this. And so you find this real backdrop of history throughout the book, and I found that it was really fascinating that India had so many problems. It had so many challenges when it was first independent. people thought it would break up. People thought that it's never going to last. You know, there's just too many castes and too many classes and so on. And yet, look at it now. I mean, people talk about the Asian century coming up. So that's something I also wanted to show in this book, how India got to where it is.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Manil Suri. His new novel is The Age of Shiva. It's just out. It's published by W.W. Norton. His first, also published by Norton, was The Death of Vishnu. It came out in 2001, was well-received, won the 2002 Barnes & Noble Discover Prize. It was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award. It was long-listed for the Booker Prize. In addition to being a writer, Manil Suri is a mathematician. He has a Ph.D. in applied math from Carnegie Mellon University and is a tenured full professor in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. He was born and raised in Bombay, now Mumbai, and came to the United States to be a student when he was 20. He's joining us by phone. Questions, welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. I wonder to what extent some of these characters, Mira included, are based at all on people that you might know or might have known at least glancingly. And I ask knowing that the death of Vishnu is about a man who lives in this apartment building where a lot of the other characters live, who lives and dies on the landing, and that I read that in Bombay when you grew up, there was indeed a man who lived and died on the landing of the apartment building where you lived, and that some, at least, of the characters maybe are in part inspired by or prompted by people that you knew, maybe even some of them that you were related to. Are there characters in The Age of Shiva that are in some way based on real people?
I think what many writers do, and myself included, is that we're basically thieves. We're always looking for little bits of things to take from various people that we meet. So certainly just about every character is going to be influenced in some way or the other by people that I know. But what I like to do is I like to take things and twist them around. So like you mentioned Vishnu, Vishnu was someone who lived and died in this building I grew up in, but I never really spoke to him more than a few words. I would just say hello to him. And so the idea in that book was to actually use his character as a diving board and then make his whole history and his whole life, make it up. Some of the neighbors who keep fighting, that was definitely out of my own life. However, I couldn't really use the real characters because my mother was still living in that apartment. So I couldn't very well, you know, have things that would make the neighbors recognize themselves. So I, again, had to change them all. In this book, The Age of Shiva, what I did was I used the fact that I know quite a bit about Rawalpindi just from hearing my parents talk about it. They actually were married on July 10th, 1947, which was the year that India was created. The Independence Day was August 15th. And on August 15th, the country was divided into two, into Pakistan and into India. So they were actually in Rawalpindi, which is now in Pakistan, and being Hindu, they had to flee. And their big story was that they didn't even open their wedding presents. They just fled for their lives, and they left everything behind. But in my family, I keep hearing about things from Rawalpindi, so that's where I set these people in this book to be from. Just writing about, you know, I could have written about my parents, about their story, but that seemed boring as a writer for myself. And so then you start twisting things around and say, okay, what if these people actually met in India? Why not look at this period around 1955 when the country was, you know, had a few years under its belt and was really springing up? There's a lot of what ifs. My father, for example, was married to my mother for over 50 years, unlike what happens in the book. And so you change things, but you also use whatever you can. One of the things that I did use was that my father was an assistant music director in Bombay. So I knew a lot of things about the music business, about what the recording studios look like. And so that's been used in my book. I'm too lazy to do research on things I don't know about. So, you know, go ahead and use that.
The India, I think, well, it's fascinating for many reasons, but I think one of the things that makes contemporary India such a compelling place and so interesting is that we have, on the one hand, an old culture and, as you say, a place where the history goes back thousands of years, where that still seems in many ways to be very much alive. And at the same time, it's, in at least in some parts of it, is a very modern country, a place that's right on the cutting edge of contemporary technology, and that it's a place where a lot of things are going on, and there is this creative tension. I suppose there's both destruction and creation going on all the time there, and it has something to do with the conflict, potential conflicts between old and new. And certainly that is something that you're interested in exploring and do explore in the book.
Right. Yeah, I was just in India for 3 weeks, and I went to five different cities. And it's quite amazing. There are cities like Hyderabad. You come in from the airport, and there are these amazing highways, these huge shops that look like something out of the U.S. And then you go a little further in, and you get to the old city, and suddenly you're transformed 200 years back into the past. So as you said, there are these enormous changes living next to each other. I mean, these different cultures almost. And it's interesting because people's lives have changed dramatically, but not everyone's life has changed. And that's one of the things that fascinates me, what's going to happen in the future. This book, The Age of Shiva, really explores how we got to the present, or the near present, to about the 1980s from independence, how India got what trajectory it took. That's what happens in the background. You know, the main story is, of course, about Mira. The death of Vishnu actually was a snapshot of the country around 1980, 1990. And so I'm very tempted for the next book to really look into the future, to project India and see what kind of future I can come up with.
Well, that's interesting, because I was just sitting here thinking that would be the natural, almost given the trajectory of the books, that would be almost the natural thing to do. And there is, I gather, this expectation that there will be a third book, and that this forms a trilogy of a sort, if only in the sense that it's stitched. I'm sure that there are a lot of ways in which it's stitched together, but that each book makes a reference to each of the three major gods of Hinduism, and Brahma. You have one left,
that you're going to do.
Have you actually started to do work on that?
I did. I've been working on it off and on for a little while now. And interestingly enough, Brahma is the creator, but he's not really a god that people worship. There's only the main temple for Brahma is in Pushkar, and that's sort of the one main temple. There are a few other minor ones, but he's sort of the one that's been left out. So that's an interesting aspect of him that, you know, for a writer is quite intriguing. Here's a god, but no one worships him. But also the fact that he's the creator. I mean, he's supposed to be the one who actually does the creation. In terms of what I've written so far, I'd actually decided that, okay, for this third book, I have to at least set part of it outside of India. And so I had these two characters in Pittsburgh, again, the lazy writer. I've been in Pittsburgh. I studied there, so why not set it there? I wrote about 100 pages and then decided just this summer that, okay, you know, these characters would work much better in Bombay. And so I've just thrown away those 100 pages. And I've written 4 pages all summer, but now the characters are in Bombay. So I seem to keep gravitating back towards India.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, again, Manil Suri. If you have questions, you'd like to be involved in the conversation, you can give us a call, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about about Mira, this woman who is the central character of The Age of Shiva, and about her, what really she's trying to do throughout the course of her life is she's trying to control her own destiny and struggles with some of the men in her life, certainly her father, that is an important force early on, her husband, and then the what turns out to be the, this big, important relationship. And it's something that she shares with a lot of other Indian women, that is this relationship between herself and her son. Is it the case that that still, for now, many Indian women, they face this kind of difficulty? That is, it is a society that I'm sure continues to be very patriarchal, that it's difficult for women to control their own destiny?
Less so now. I think it depends on where you are. I think what's happening now is that women are getting into the workforce more and more. They have more economic freedom, and therefore they're better equipped to control their own destiny. I think in terms of villages, I would suspect that the situation is still pretty much unchanged. There's still dowry and all those ills that have come to us from the past that are very difficult to eradicate. The main difference is that there are efforts being made to spread more education, and that I think is the key. Once people get more educated, things change. Even the ratio of men to women, which is very high in India in general, especially in some of the more impoverished states, that changes as well. So, for example, in Kerala, which is probably the most educated state in India, that ratio is almost even. But in other states, it might not be.
I had the opportunity last year to talk with Vikram Chandra, who I know you helped you, I think, in looking at some of the early material that you had written for the last book, and gave you encouragement. And I had the chance to talk with him about Sacred Games, which is I think an enormously entertaining book, and it's an enormous book both. And one of the things that I think is very striking about it is just how effective I think it is at giving you a sense of Bombay culture. And certainly it is full of words in Hindi and in words that people around, slang that people in Bombay use, and some other Indian languages as well. So to the extent that actually if you're going to get hung up on that, it can make it a little difficult to read. There's a big glossary in the back of the book that he's included, so that if you want to know what those words mean, you can. And then I think also as you read the book, if you would just like to pass over them, you probably still can. And it is possible to pick up some very colorful language that you wouldn't want to use on the radio. You have some Hindi words in your book, and I wonder how you think about, you know, steering this course between having something that is really, really deeply into the culture and the day-to-day life of India, and at the same time having a book that someone who is not Indian is not going to have too much difficulty reading.
It's tough. It takes a long time. So for each Hindi word that I use, I really have to think about it, how to bring out its meaning just through the context, how to give the reader a fighting chance to know what that Hindi word means. And the reason I do that is because of two reasons. First of all, Hindi is not something spoken throughout India. So even if you're aiming for an Indian audience, people in the South might not understand what a certain word might mean. And the other thing is that when I read a book that's written by a foreign author, I don't know German, for instance, and that there's a lot of German words or German text in a book, I don't go to a dictionary. I just sort of skip over that or hope that I somehow figure out what the author is saying. So I think that's why I try to make every endeavor to really give the reader a fighting chance. The other reason, I think, is also being a mathematician, I'm just very sensitive to how difficult it is sometimes to convey information the way you want to. And so I think I'm really interested in, I have a precise idea of what I'm trying to say, and I would like the reader to know that. So that's why I think you might find it easier to understand many of the words through the context.
Mm-hmm. The book starts out, and this is just, it's not long after independence and partition, and that I think for a lot of the people in this story, this partition particularly still is still feels like a very raw, open sore. And I suppose for some people it remains that way now, lo, these many years after. How much do you think the kind of tensions that exist between Hindus and Muslims in India is a problem or a potential problem for the future?
So first of all, in terms of the partition, I think a lot of the scars have healed. As I said, I was in India, several different cities, and one of the cities was Calcutta, which is now called Kolkata. And of course, the country was partitioned on that side as well. East Pakistan was carved out of the country, and so there were many Hindus in that area that came to Kolkata. And one of the interviewers that I had for a newspaper was from one such family, which even though geographically and culturally is very different from my family, which was from the Punjab, the experience was so similar that he really could identify with the characters in the book. But I do feel that the generation that was directly affected by the partition has either passed on or has really reconciled themselves to whatever they've built in India. So I do think that there are still a lot of tensions between Hindus and Muslims. I don't think that's ever going to go away. And I do think that that is going to be something significant in the future. If you have such a heterogeneous society like India, with so many different factions and so many different religions, it's really hard to imagine an India that would be completely strife-free, that there wouldn't be people fighting each other or even killing each other. You're always going to have some of that, which is the unfortunate thing, but it's just going to be with us. So a certain level of that is to be expected. The question is, you know, is that going to increase? Is that going to remain the same? Is it going to decrease? And I suspect there's going to be some sort of cyclical type movement where in certain decades you're going to find that this is increasing, and in certain decades things are going to be more peaceful.
Mm-hmm. It seems that in the recent years, maybe not just recent, that Indian writers or Indian-American writers have been very successful in the United States. And certainly there are people who write in English who are not Americans who have been successful in the United States, writers from Canada and from Britain and from Ireland and from Africa. But it seems that the writers from the Indian subcontinent, that something about them or their fiction has grabbed American readers. And I wonder what you think that might be.
Well, I think the most successful Indian writers right now in the U.S. are probably software writers.
Yes, I take the point. Yeah.
Yeah, but in terms of literature, it's interesting that I think it started, I suspect, with Salman Rushdie, and then the big breakthrough for Indian writers was The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy, which sold a lot of copies and introduced a lot of American readers to Indian writers who write in English. And of course, there have been many big names. You were mentioning Vikram Chandra, and there's the other Vikram, Vikram Seth, who's also very well known. I'm not sure whether there's some reason behind it or what can be said about that. I suspect that India is just a place that's so full of possibility, that there's so much drama going on. When I think about, you know, the example I was giving of my own book, the next book, where I shifted the action from America to back to India, it just seemed that I would just have many more possibilities there. So there's just a lot of potential, I find, for drama in India, and maybe that's what some of the readers are really enjoying. I do think that a lot of these successful books, they are books which are successful not because they're exotic or anything like that, but because the characters in them are very well developed, and they bring out certain characteristics that are common to all of us. And maybe that's the other thing that people are really plugging into. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Manuel Sori. He was born and raised in Bombay, now Mumbai, came to the U.S. as a student when he was 20. He is a novelist. He's published now two. His first, The Death of Vishnu, was published by Norton in 2001. It won the 2002 Barnes & Noble Discover Prize, was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award, was longlisted for the Booker Prize, was a New York Times notable book for 2001. His new novel is The Age of Shiva. It's also published by W.W. Norton. It's just recently out. In addition to being a writer, Manuel Sori is also a mathematician. He's professor in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Others would be welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Caller is in Effingham on our line number 4. Hello?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Your guest has given some historical perspective in his writings about India and 1947 and all those events in Gandhi. My question is the first one: where do Indians fit into the progression out of Africa? If that's a historical question, I know. But and then bring it up to date a little, the status of Kashmir.
So for the first question, I would suspect that you're talking about it in terms of where Indian civilization came from.
It's how it lined up behind or with the travel from the Great Rift Valley in all directions, and, you know, how that evolved.
Okay, I'm not very familiar with that. In terms of the history that I was taught, and we never really delved into the origins, but the earliest civilizations in India were along the Indus Valley, and I don't know whether those predate the civilizations you're talking about or if they're somehow linked to them. But, you know, I'm not an expert at that, and I'm not going to venture into that.
Thank you.
In terms of your other question, Kashmir, that's just one of those situations that, you know, keeps, again, there is progress sometimes, and then things die down again. The whole problem, of course, started after independence, and there's a little bit of that I talk about in the book as well. But right now, it seems like I just don't see how this can be resolved, just because what's happened is that even from what I understand, Al-Qaeda and some of those organizations have gotten involved in this and taken up the cause of making Kashmir independent or joining it with Pakistan as part of a sort of global Islamic type activity. And so it's very hard to see how the two countries, Pakistan and India, will be able to disentangle the fate of the Kashmiris from these external sources, these external powers that have vested interests in it.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller. We just have about maybe 4 or 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. If someone wants to get in real quick with a question, they certainly may. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I mentioned that you were born in India, born in Bombay, and then came to the United States to be a student when you were 20. In what way do you see these two parts of you, that is the part that's American and the part that's Indian, or do you in fact think of yourself as being a kind of a I know that you're a citizen of both countries, you have dual citizenship. Do you think that there is a way in which you are both an American and continue to be an Indian?
Absolutely. I think when I first came to this country, like many others, well, first of all, I should even go back. When I was growing up, in a very, I was going to a school that was what we call a convent school, which was run by Jesuits, and it was a very Western-looking school, so things that were Indian were almost frowned upon, and we were, I think, actually encouraged to adopt a more Western attitude. And so when I came to the U.S., that just seemed right because, okay, here's the West. You've been looking towards it all your life, and now you're there. Mm-hmm. And so that was wonderful in many ways. And then it took several years for me to really start thinking back about roots and, you know, what where I came from and the Eastern part of me, so to speak. And it was really through the writing of The Death of Vishnu that I got pulled back to India. And now with this book, especially with seeing this link that I feel towards Indian history and getting my dual citizenship and so on, I do feel like I'm a big part of me is Indian. And so it's almost, there's a part of me that almost kind of recoils a bit at this just because it's sort of like the prodigal son coming back to India when India is now doing well. But I think culturally there are certain ties that never die out and have been very pleasantly regenerated.
Hmm. We'll talk with one more caller here, at least someone on the campus. It's line number one. Hello?
Hello? Yes? Let me first tell you that, you know, I am also a faculty here, not in mathematics, but I'm more into statistics and economics, and I read your Vishnu when it came out at one sitting, and I look forward to reading your, you know, the new one, Shiva, and maybe when Brahma comes out. And my question is, maybe I don't know, I'm talking to the middle of this program, I don't know whether you call it, and how do you reconcile between Manil Suri, the mathematician, and Manil Suri, the writer? So that's my question.
We talked about that a little bit at the beginning, but I think that's fine to... I think that that's fine to raise the question, and I'll give our guest a chance to talk about that.
Well, the big question is, which comes first? And I think that when I was writing The Death of Vishnu, I was definitely a mathematician with a hobby that was writing. And what's happened over the past 7 years is that I have to admit that the focus has sort of shifted. And I do feel that I'm now a writer. That's sort of my primary calling right now. But mathematics is still very much a part of my life. And the struggle that I'm going through is trying to reconcile these, trying to unify these in some way. And that's very hard. These two topics are so far apart. I've actually been dabbling with some things where trying to make mathematics more palatable to people who don't like it, doing outreach and so on. There's even something that I put on YouTube, which is a lecture on infinity for people who are not mathematicians. So I'm very interested in seeing how these two diverse fields will kind of amalgamate later on.
Can I interject now? Mm-hmm. In terms of, say, called life and livelihood, so which one is now your life and livelihood, mathematics or this writing? Can you put that in that session?
In terms of creativity, you mean?
Or life. Say, think about life, you know, and livelihood. So suddenly you started your livelihood in mathematics.
Well, what do I get paid from, you mean?
Right, exactly. Right.
Oh, I'm not going to discuss my finances on the radio. Sorry about that.
Not finances, your activities. You mean, do you still teach at the...
Yeah, I still teach. In fact, I was teaching until...
Teaching?
Yes, I teach full-time. I'm not teaching this semester because I have to promote my book, but I teach full-time, yes.
All right,
thank you.
Well, it's there's a colleague of mine and who works here who, like me, is one of those people who has always had a difficult time with math. And we've talked occasionally about why that is, and I remember her saying something about how the problem with math books is that you open them up and you look at them and there are no words in them. So I think that we could use some writer mathematicians. Maybe that would do something for those of us who seem to have we're drawn to words and dealing with words, and somehow numbers we have a difficult time connecting with them.
And even better than words are pictures. So once again, I will point your listeners to YouTube. Type in my name and watch this video.
So now we're coming down to the point where we pretty much have to finish. Now, you have made a start on what will be the the third book in this connected series of three. Do you have a working title for this book?
I have a working title. It's The Birth of Brahma. I'm probably going to change the word birth, but I haven't decided on which one. And the more important question is how long I'll take to finish this. Given that it took me 5 years for the first, 7 years for the second, and I almost shudder to think the next number in that sequence. But I think the best I can do, I made a calculation, is to try and finish it in 4 years. So that's my goal.
Hmm. And you expect that you will continue to be teaching at the same time so that you'll have to be continuing to divide your time and your energy between both of those things.
Absolutely. I just find that, I went a little crazy over these past 7 years trying to finish this second book, and I would have been completely loony if I wasn't a mathematician, if I didn't have that profession to keep me sane.
So you wouldn't consider taking time off from math and just taking as long as it would take full time to write and to finish the next book?
I think I will probably take a year off, but I don't think I would want to extend it beyond that, because then I start getting a little stir crazy.
Well, the book that we have talking about here this morning, actually, there are two books we've talked about. The Death of Vishnu, that's Manuel Suri's first novel that was published in 2001 and is now available in paperback, was originally published by Norton, W.W. Norton. And his new book is The Age of Shiva, and it is now out in hardcover. It is published by W.W. Norton, so I'm sure that you can find both of those books at the library, the bookstore, if you'd like to read them. In addition to being a writer, our guest Manuel Suri is professor in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. And Professor Suri, thank you very much.
Thank you.